Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Friday, February 1st, 2019. Containers of illegal ivory and pangolin are seized at the Uganda-South Sudan border.
We controlled the trucks arriving in Kampala. We arrested them and we've been scanning each, and on opening, we are estimating about 750 pieces of ivory.
An unidentified armed man killed civilians around Yei River State.
I was riding on my motorbike towards Yei town and I fell into an ambush. I was shot at several times by the armed men, and I thank God because I escaped alive.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Three major international busts have underscored the continued demand for ivory and pangolin scales despite a ban on trade in the endangered species. Hong Kong Customs said today it had intercepted a record 8 tons of pangolin scales, representing about 13,000 of the scale anteaters and more than 1,000 ivory tusks. The shippers used ice bags and frozen meat to try to hide the items. The shipment originated in Nigeria and was bound for Vietnam. Officials estimated it was worth nearly $8 million. Meanwhile, the Vietnam news agency reported that customs officials in Haiphong found another 1.4 tons of pangolin scales in a shipping container sent from Nigeria. Conservation group Wild Aid estimates 100,000 pangolins are poached from the wild each year. 8 species of pangolin in Africa and Asia are now under threat. Yesterday, Uganda announced it has intercepted millions of dollars worth of ivory and pangolin at the border with South Sudan. Catherine Nambi has more for VOA from Kampala.
The meticulous concealment on 3 trucks was unearthed by a non-intrusive cargo inspection scanner. The smugglers poured molten wax into hollow chunks of wood and dipped hundreds of ivory and pangolin scales into the wax. Dickson Kateshumba is the Commissioner Customs at Uganda Revenue Authority.
We got intelligence that these people are concealing these items, and we controlled the trucks arriving in Kampala. We arrested them and we've been scanning each, and on opening, we are estimating about 750 pieces of ivory.
Kateshumba says the origin and destination of the ivory is still unknown. He adds that it is an act by a huge racket still at large.
We suspect this to be elephants which have been killed either in DRC or Central African Republic or many other places, and they are being transited through. Obviously, we are investigating the whole racket because these are things which can trade in these items, can aid conflict in the region. Because we are talking of big money involved, millions of dollars involved. And that's why we are trying to investigate the entire chain so that we have the whole network of people involved, and we take them to court.
According to Kateshumba, those arrested will be prosecuted according to the Ugandan laws.
We have charges under the customs law, but there are other charges under the penal code and the Wildlife Act. So we will do a joint prosecution. So that they can get the most punitive punishment. Under the customs law, there is an offense. Trading in illegal is an offense of concealment.
Between 2009 and 2014, an estimated 20 metric tons of ivory was trafficked through Uganda, mainly to Asia. But Kateshumba says this inspection should sound a warning to all involved in smuggling of any nature that the Ugandan borders are increasingly becoming impenetrable.
They were in coffee husks. But this is an industrial process. You can see that they cut the logs, created boxes inside, put the logs, melted the wax, fixed it, sealed. It is sophisticated. That shows that they knew that Uganda is a difficult territory to just pass through. So they had to go through a lot.
According to Wildlife Site, the conservation, the population of African elephants is estimated to have declined by 111,000 over the past 10 years. East Africa has experienced an almost 50% reduction in its elephant population. This is Catherine Nambi for VOA News in Kampala.
Five civilians were killed Thursday on the outskirts of Yei Town. Yei River State Information Minister Zakaria Duku Enoka accuses rebels of the National Salvation Front of carrying out the attack. Daniel Friday Martin reports for VOA from Yei Town.
Eyewitnesses say unknown gunmen ambushed the civilian 7 miles southwest of Yei Town along the Yei Lasu Road. Speaking in his native Kakwa, an eyewitness who prefers to be identified only as Peter for fear of reprisals from the armed men described what happened.
Mola kaja hasil kunakilo na ponda exactly 8:30.
At around 8:30, I was traveling from my village, and unfortunately, I met some armed rebels at a village called Nyarju. They directed us under a gunpoint some few meters into the bush. They hit me with a machete on my head and I fell down. They removed my clothes. One of my colleagues whom we came together with was cut on the head and died on spot. There was a small young boy in our midst. They tied him down. They said to themselves to let the boy die on his own. And also before I fell into the ambush, I saw 5 more other dead bodies lying on the ground in a place called Rubeke.
At Ye Civil Hospital, Dr. Rupert Bojo says Peter's responding well to treatment after surgery.
He was cut in the scalp from behind, around 15 to 20 centimeters long, and then with several other injuries on the back of the neck. We were able to stitch all the wounds, and then the other thing is he was also injured on both feet. Today morning he's stable, he's doing well, but so for the healing to take place it will need some time where it's supposed not to move so that it can heal well.
Speaking in Kakwa, another survivor who had identified himself only as David for security reasons says he was shot at several times by the armed men. He says he narrowly escaped from the attackers at Nyaju village. David says fighting between government and NAS fighters continued in several villages of Otogo County over the past days.
I was riding on my motorbike towards Yei Town and I fell into an ambush. I was shot at several times by the armed men and I thank God because I escaped alive. In our village, the rebels ordered us not to come into Yei Town, but we don't have access to salt and soap. We also heard by our own ears the sound of heavy guns in some of our nearby villages. We have heard that peace deal was signed, but we don't have peace in the villages because we are suffering like slaves.
Yei River State authorities accused National Salvation Front forces of attacking and killing unarmed civilians in Yei River State. Zakaria Duku is the Minister for Information in Yei River State.
The National Salvation Front actions of killing, either by guns or slaughter, by knives, abductions, torture, and looting of property have targeted and threatened the lives of civilians in Yei River State. And the government of Yei River State calls upon the transitional government of national unity, the IGAD, CITISAM, and the AU to assist in ending the activities of National Salvation Front in Yei River State.
Samuel Subamanas is the spokesman for the National Salvation Front rebels led by General Thomas Srilo, who declined to sign the revised September peace deal. Soba says his forces have not killed civilians and claims the Yei River State government is behind the killings in villages around the state. Due to the poor quality of the phone line, we are voicing Soba's response.
I want the people of South Sudan and Yei to understand that the forces of National Salvation Front does not have the culture of slaughtering civilians. The government has moved deep into the villages, more especially in the sites of Morobu and Ombasi, and shooting down civilians suspected to be supporters of National Salvation Movement. We are not responsible for any killing because our enemies are the government soldiers, not the civilians.
Razav Mohandis, a civil society activist who is a signatory of the revitalized peace deal, is urging all parties to respect the cessation of hostilities agreement signed in December 2017 and protect civilians under their areas of control. Mohandis condemned violations of the ceasefire and urged all parties to protect civilians under their areas of control.
As a civil society, we are saddened by these incidences of continued harassment and killing and abductions and torture of civilians in Yei area. We condemn this strongly, and we call on the leaders of the forces in the area to ensure that they prevail over their forces to respect civilians and their right to free movement throughout Yei areas.
According to the cessation of hostilities and permanent security arrangements, all forces in the conflict in South Sudan are supposed to protect civilians and allow free movement. For VOA News, I'm Daniel Friday Martin in Yei Town.
Gerard Jenser, a lawyer and director of the Washington-based Persis Strategies, also founder of Freedom Now, which works to free political prisoners, is now taking on the case of South Sudanese activist Peter Bier Ajak, who was arrested in South Sudan 6 months ago. Jenser says Bier's rights have been repeatedly violated under international law, and he is appealing to the UN Human Rights Council to take urgent action.
Quite clear to me, of course, that he's being arbitrarily detained. He's been held without charge or trial for more than 6 months, and for no good reason other than speaking his mind and calling for a generational exit to the problems of South Sudan.
Now, you actually wrote that Ajak's arrest and detention are politically motivated. Why do you think that?
Because, in fact, when he was detained, we learned that in the terms of reference for the investigators, they were specifically instructed to examine his social media posts, his television appearances, and his involvement with the South Sudan Young Leaders Forum, the NGO that he founded. So it's quite clear when you look at those posts and appearances, and you learn about his NGO, exactly what he stands for, who he is, that he's advocated nonviolence his entire life. Really all he's done has been a vocal critic of the government and of all leaders in South Sudan for failing to achieve a sustainable peace for its people. You know, clearly everything that he is doing falls very squarely within the internationally protected right to freedom of opinion and expression and his right to free speech. And it's also equally clear that, he's being detained in flagrant violation of his rights to due process under both South Sudan law and international law.
So then what is your legal strategy? I know that part of it involves the United Nations.
Sure. Well, I've spent a career working on freeing political prisoners around the world, and it's been my experience that the governments release political prisoners when the cost of detaining them substantially outweigh the benefits. Undoubtedly, Peter is a very effective, charismatic, and vocal critic of the government, and which is why they've decided to unfortunately detain him. And ultimately, we need to combine a very clear and straightforward strategy of combining legal, political, and public relations advocacy to secure his release.
Now, there's a lot of challenges to this case. For one, it's in South Sudan, and you're here in Washington. Could you talk to me about other challenges that you may have thought of and what your plans are to overcome them?
Well, look, at the end of the day, my hope is that President Kiir will understand over time that this is just not a necessary act for him to take. You know, in my experience, presidents who are strong and governments that are strong have no reason to fear their critics because they can address their concerns and their criticism head on with cogent and clear arguments in response. What I also find pretty compelling about what Peter has done as a peace activist, is that he hasn't taken any one side in the process in South Sudan, but he's spoken to the desire of all young people in South Sudan to have a sustainable peace and to have a future where they can have access to education and healthcare and good jobs and live their lives free from fear.
Are you able to communicate with him at all?
I can't communicate with him at all. He's not able to make phone calls. I'm obviously in touch with his family and with local council, and I'm getting reports from how he's doing there. Taking a case to the United Nations, is easily done from abroad. But ultimately, we're going to have to work many different channels in order to try to secure his freedom.
Directly or indirectly, there's a chance that Peter might hear this interview. What is your message to him?
Well, I think that the biggest fear of any political prisoner is that they've been forgotten. And Peter, you're remembered. The world knows your story, and people admire you enormously around the world, and we're not going to rest until you're free. And we cannot live in a world where people like Peter are arbitrarily detained. We have to persist and persevere, and we'll do whatever is necessary within the bounds of the law to bring enormous pressure onto the government of South Sudan to resolve his detention.
That was Gerard Jensen, the lawyer of Peter Bier Ajak. He was speaking to Ayen Dengbior from Washington yesterday. You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, South Sudanese students studying medicine abroad say they need support from their government. Find out when we come back.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. Question today.
What is your golden rule in life?
My golden rule is never to give up, no matter what, whether it's on family challenges, money problems, work related, I just never give up.
Golden rule. No, I don't allow men to play with my life. That is my golden rule. And I don't allow anyone to talk ill about my parents and my family.
Put God first, because in everything you need God. And as you know, the fearing of God is the beginning of knowledge.
Not to lie, I always want to base my living, everything I do, my speaking, my saying, in facts and truth.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. South Sudanese students studying at various medical schools in Cuba are appealing to the government in Juba for financial support. The students claim since they received a Cuban scholarship in 2014, the South Sudan government and its embassy in Havana refused to support them. The Minister of Higher Education says the South Sudan government is only responsible for the students' plane tickets to Cuba. Online Walter Solomon has more for VOA from Juba.
24-year-old Giovanni Wani is one of the 26 students studying medicine in Santiago, 870 kilometers southeast of the Cuban capital, Havana. Wani says although the Cuban government gives each student 100 pesos, the equivalent of $4 a month, it is not nearly enough to cover the cost of their basic needs.
With $4, you cannot photocopy materials. You cannot buy a pen or papers, even transport, to buy like food and other things. The food they give us here in the school is not that enough, and even not nice or good food for the health of the person. Now we have like 4 or 5 students who have peptic ulcers and gastritis because of the quality of food that they give.
Just as important, when he says most of the students have no money for renewing their expired passports. He says without a valid passport, the students are not able to perform medical work at Cuban hospitals as required by medical schools.
Here we have different hospitals, like pediatric hospital, surgery hospital, and all of those different sectors. And as long as you are rotating in these hospitals, you have to travel and have to go within the city. The Cuban government does expect our government to support us like the rest of the countries. Like here, we have students from Angola, Uganda, from Ethiopia, and many countries in Africa. They do receive financial support from their home countries.
When he claims the government of South Sudan has not responded to several requests for help.
First, we have started with South Sudan Embassy in Addis Ababa. We wrote a letter, but no reply. We wrote more than twice to the Minister of Higher Education. One of the letters reached up to him because by that time I was the head of the South Sudanese Students Union in Cuba, and I got in touch with the minister, and he promised that he is going to give this issue to those responsible of the foreign students in the Ministry of Higher Education.
Yen Oral Tut, South Sudan Minister of Higher Education, denies his ministry promised the students any payment at the time of their admission to Cuban universities.
How much did the government promise? But what I know so far, when they went, I was not in the ministry. But the record I'm having, that they went on the full paid scholarship that is fully paid by the hosting country, which is the Cuban country. The government of South Sudan did not send them to pay for their scholarship.
When he says, aside from not having enough money for school supplies or food, three female South Sudan students are having difficulties buying sanitary pads. For VOA News, I am Onan Walter Solomon in Juba.
Still on medical matters, last year more than 70,000 Americans fatally overdosed narcotics such as heroin, Exedon, and other opioid drugs. President Donald Trump has declared the opioid crisis a national public health emergency, but conventional approaches to fighting addiction offer mixed results. Enter EBGA, a psychotropical plant sacred to Africa's Bwiti people. Advocates say EBGA's active ingredient minimizes or eliminates withdrawal symptoms, offers addicts life-changing psychological insights, and reduces drug craving over the long term. VOA's Adam Phillips has this report.
Why do opioid addicts have such a hard time quitting? One reason is because the physical effects of abrupt withdrawal can seem far worse than staying hooked. However, Ibogaine seems to block those effects, says Thomas Kingsley Brown of the University of California in San Diego. Brown conducted a small observational study of clinical Ibogaine treatment in Mexico, one of only eight nations where Ibogaine is either legal or unregulated. In an article he co-wrote for the American Journal of Drug and Alcohol Abuse, he says 23% of the subjects were still opioid-free after 1 year, and other studies report a 50% success rate.
Our study also showed that people, when they have the Ibogaine treatment, they are able to establish much better relationships with their family members and their close friends and their spouses over the long term.
Conventional addiction treatments often rely on addictive replacement drugs, such as methadone and buprenorphine. Some addicts try to taper off their use or stop cold, an approach that studies suggest produce a scant 10 to 20% success rate. The problem, Ibogaine advocates say, is that neither method addresses the underlying psychological reasons why people use addictive drugs and why they tend to relapse after they quit. But Ibogaine treatments are different. Within an hour of ingesting a dose of Ibogaine, patients enter a dreamlike psychedelic state where they can revisit the emotional wounds that led to their drug use and become aware of its impact on themselves and others. That's what made all the difference for Dimitri Mugianis of New York.
It saved a wretch like me.
In 2002, Mugianis was 40 and a longtime heroin, cocaine, and alcohol addict living in his parents' basement and contemplating suicide. As a last resort, he went to an Ibogaine clinic in the Netherlands. Within an hour of taking the Ibogaine capsule, his withdrawal symptoms subsided and a three-day inner voyage began.
I was able to deal with my physical and sexual abuse as a child. I was able to deal and forgive my father for some of his violent behavior. I was able to see ancestral patterns, visit ancestors, see my dead wife who died while using drugs and was pregnant and I had a lot of guilt for. I was able to relieve myself of the guilt and also take responsibility for what I had done. It was a very difficult experience, but you come out of it and you realize, yeah, I did that, but I can change and I can live my life in a different way. It actually showed me that I could feel happy, joyous, and free.
Today, Mugianis is still opioid-free and leads Ibogaine retreats in Mexico. Deborah Mash, a neuropharmacologist at the University of Miami and a leading expert on the drug, touts another important feature. Ibogaine leaves the body within a day, but before it does, some metabolizes into noribogaine, which reduces the psychological craving and depression that often trigger relapse.
I've been studying Ibogaine since the early 1990s, and I have seen it save lives. And I get phone calls from people who are clean and sober for over 10 years. One or two treatments have helped them. It's not a cure, but it is a powerful first step on the road to recovery.
Ibogaine treatment does carry risks. There have been reports of death from adverse reactions, mostly due to unsupervised use, undiagnosed heart problems, or the mixture of ibogaine with other drugs. But MASH says that rigorous pre-screening and close medical supervision diminish those risks. Still, more FDA-approved research and clinical trials are needed. If ibogaine's promise is borne out, MASH is hopeful that the FDA will fast-track the drug to market and make it easily available to the millions who need it. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
Cameroon's arrested opposition leader, Maurice Kamto, and his supporters have started a hunger strike a day after they were told they will face 8 charges amounting to treason. Lawyers say if found guilty, they could face the death penalty, as Muki Edwin Kinzika reports from Yaoundé.
Christopher Ndong, Secretary General of the Cameroon Renaissance Movement, said Friday that arrested opposition leaders are on an indefinite hunger strike. He said the party's chair, Maurice Kamto, and 29 of his supporters arrested with him this past week would take part. Ndong said the strikers aim to show that President Paul Biya's re-election to a 7th term in October was, in his words, a stolen victory.
Kamto wants that this government should give way because they are not legitimate. After the 7th of October 2018 polls, he won the elections. And he wants that they should honestly hand down power without shame, because he is saying if they think that what he declared as a winner is false, let us go back and do a recount.
The opposition calls for a recount of the October votes are likely to fall on deaf ears. President Biya is Africa's second longest ruling leader in power for 36 years, and his government has shown little tolerance for opposition. Police arrested Kamto and 9 party officials on Monday after days of peaceful protest in Yaoundé and 3 other cities ended in clashes. Government spokesman René Emmanuel Sadi said police shot and wounded 7 protesters and arrested 117. Opposition supporters put the number of arrests at more than 200. Kamto and his colleagues are now facing 8 charges, including treason, inciting violence, and disruption of public peace. Cameroon Bar Council lawyer Mojem Fombat says if found guilty, the men could be facing the death penalty.
Article 102 of the Penal Code sanctions hostility against the fatherland. Any citizen taking part in hostility against the Republic shall be guilty of treason and punished with death.
Opposition supporters also stormed Cameroon's embassies in Paris and Berlin on Saturday. Minor damage and stolen documents were reported at the Paris embassy, which was temporarily closed. In Yaoundé, authorities summoned the French ambassador to demand that protesters who stormed the embassy be extradited to face charges. Rights group Amnesty International has called on Cameroon to release all peaceful protesters, including Kamto. Moki Edwin Kinzika for VOA News, Yaoundé.
That's our show for this Friday. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for listening. Have a safe weekend and join us again next week for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Meanwhile, I leave you with Victoria Ole. Yeah.
Jodonga kozana duma. Kwilili yesi.